Now, last time I said something about socialist movements, and today then I must come to Karl Marx, always paying attention to the fact that Marx and Engels are different people with different viewpoints and different backgrounds, and the importance of this we shall see soon enough. And I want to come to Karl Marx first, of course, and though I don't believe in reducing a major thinker to his autobiography, I think in this post-Freudian age, it's very important to make certain biographical observations about his early youth and childhood. Marx was born in 1918 in the city of Trier in the Rhineland. Now, this is not without its own importance, because when I talk in a few minutes about the enormous influence of France on Marx, the Rhineland is a border region between Germany and France. He came from a family in which Rousseau was the most read author. His future father-in-law, von Westphalen, was an impassioned liberal, and eventually Karl Marx was extremely close to his father-in-law. Now, the city of Trier had only very recently come to be part of Prussia. And Marx's father, who was a lawyer, was passionately involved in the fight for the independence of the city of Trier against Prussia. Heinrich Marx was a true man of the Enlightenment. His mottos were justice, truth, and the Marseillaise, really. He was typical of what we might call the enlightened Jewish bourgeoisie at the time. And because he was enlightened, and because he wanted to make a career in the city of Trier as the champion of the city of Trier against Prussia, he converted to Christianity very late in his life, purely as an entrance ticket to a career in Trier as a champion of justice and truth, as he would have put it, against Prussian domination. Moreover, the gymnasium which the young Karl Marx attended had a very similar direction. His teachers were, by and large, people of the Enlightenment. And from the first, Marx grew up in an atmosphere saturated with Rousseau and Voltaire, but also saturated with a spirit of rebellion, a spirit of rebellion against authority, in this case, the authority of Prussia over the city of Trier, but also at the same time concern with social misery in a town with grave economic problems. Karl Marx was born in 1918 in Trier. Oddly enough, the same year the railway came to Trier. But the railway did not improve matters in Trier, which was, as we would say, a very depressed area of the Rhineland. And so the fight against Prussia was intimately connected with the fight for more economic well-being in what was an extremely depressed town at the time. We have preserved the essays that Karl Marx wrote as a high school student, that he wrote in school. And already in these essays, which are on subjects like Rousseau and Voltaire, you can see an idea of social conditions as restricting human actions. Now, I wouldn't make too much of that, except to say that Marx's education was already saturated with French ideas, like the enlightened Jewish bourgeoisie in Germany in general. It looked to France, this will never end among what we might call the haute bourgeoisie of the Enlightenment in Germany. It will always look to France. It will always talk French at home. France, the country of the Enlightenment and of the French Revolution. But Karl Marx came from this kind of an atmosphere where the discussion was not about things German, but about Enlightenment philosophy from France. That, I think, must be clear. His relationship with his parents, by and large, were neither more or less stormy than that of the rest of the men of his particular social standing. They were quite good, especially with his mother, so good that when Karl Marx married into the small nobility, the daughter of this great liberal, Jenny von Westphalen, his daughter, Mrs. Marx did what one did then. He gave the Marxes her maid. And the nice thing about that is Engels wrote a wonderful essay about the maid of the Marxes. She stayed with Karl Marx until his death and is buried in the same tomb as Mr. and Mrs. Marx. When you go to Highgate Cemetery in London and look at the tomb, there are three people there: Marx, Mrs. Marx, and this maid. So that it was a kind of a traditional household in this regard. And Karl Marx throughout his life was extremely close to his mother, extremely close to his mother, more oddly enough than to his father. His personal relations with his family on the whole were extremely good, and with his in-laws, extremely close, extremely close. Now Marx, therefore, came from a kind of environment which you might say was marginal, newly emancipated, struggling for recognition, and therefore embracing wholeheartedly the ideas of the Enlightenment. Because it is the Enlightenment, after all, that it emancipated the Jews. It's the Enlightenment that was universal, that had the universalism within it. But of course, let us be clear, men grow and evolve, and Marx is no exception. It would, I think, be ridiculous to try a kind of Freudian analysis on Marx himself. I think that would not lead to anything. For one thing, remember what Marx lived through. He lived through extremely disturbed times indeed. He lived through the Revolution of 1848. He lived through the French Commune of 1870. He did not die until 1883. So, of course, he evolved. He grew. He changed his mind. And his youth is perhaps important as giving him a good starting point for social criticism. This is, of course, always true with those who have the good fortune as being born on the margin of society. They have a very good fortune, much better than most of you who are born in the center, because they don't have that pull to conformity. And therefore, they have a good start for radical and critical activity. I myself have been delighted that I was and always have been at the margin of society. Of course, as a refugee, as an immigrant, always at the margin. So I've never had that horrible handicap most of you had, that I have been rooted and therefore have been dragged down to a kind of complacency. Well, Marx never had that either. He came from the margins of society. Nothing worse than being rooted. The margins of society. Now, that's one thing that is, of course, extremely important here. And the other, again, and I'll come back to that in a minute, is the French influence. And, of course, the basic influence of the Enlightenment. For whatever we shall say about the problems of Marxism, Marx is basically a man of the Enlightenment, And without the Enlightenment, he cannot be understood at all without that background. Now, Friedrich Engels outlived Marx for 12 years. He didn't die till 1895. And that is fateful, because it was Engels who codified Marx, and much of Marxism, as it will be transmitted, is not Marx at all, but Engels. And Engels had quite a different attitude. For one thing, between 1883 and 1885, something of vast importance happened, the popularization of Darwin. Marx really did not know Darwin very well, but Engels knew Darwin. So a totally new dimension, as we shall see, gets into Marxism, the scientific dimension, which is missing with Marx. He died before Darwin had become well known. Engels, of course, in his famous speech at the tomb of Marx, when Marx died in 1883, Engels made the famous speech in Highgate Cemetery where he called Marx the Darwin of social sciences. And Engels was much influenced by that. Much of the determinism, the historical materialism, is Engels rather than Marx. Now, to be sure, both Engels and Marx came from a bourgeois milieu, but a quite a different one, of course. Engels came from a conventional, rather prosperous, German and Christian family, of course. And in his youth, Engels had, if you like, a traditional German youth. He joined a university fraternity. His great heroes of his youth was Siegfried, as a matter of fact. And it took Engels a great many years to arrive at Hegelianism. Come back to that in a minute, in which he met Marx. But Engels came from quite a different background, had to overcome much bigger obstacles before he joined what you might call in Berlin the radical student movement. It took him much longer to join this radical student movement. He was at first, and that will remain, and I think in my culture of Western Europe I tried to make clear how this will remain with Engels to a large extent, this kind of, if you like, national thrust, national German thrust. Now, where did Engels and Marx meet? They met at the University of Berlin, where they were both studying to take the doctorate. Now, the great influence in the 40s at the University of Berlin among the radicals, the Herbert Marcuse of his time, was none other than a man who had died 10 years earlier, Hegel. Hegel, who had already died 10 years earlier, was still the great influence at the University of Berlin among the radical students. And it is among the radical student movement at the University of Berlin which Marx and Engels met. And these radical student movement, which we call the Young Hegelians, because that's what they called themselves, they said, "We are young Hegelians," because after all, as you will see, they revised the teaching of the master. Young Hegelians, they met under the auspices of another student, a student who was, as a way, the intellectual leader of these young students in the 30s and early 40s at the University of Berlin. And that young leader was a man by the name of Ruge. Now, Ruge was not only a young student leader. Ruge also did what so many radicals do and did. He founded a journal in order to express this kind of radicalism. A journal, of course, which has become very famous because it is there that Marx and Engels first wrote. And he found it in his native cities, and he called it, after his native city, the so-called Annals of Halle.
Halle in Saxony.
The so-called Annals of Halle, the Annalen von Halle, became after 1838, when Ruge founded it, the kind of organ, the journal, of these young radical Hegelians who took the teachings of the master, 10 years dead, at the University of Berlin and gave it a revolutionary slant, a revolutionary slant, the teaching then of the master. Now, Karl Marx said, typically enough, a little later, when he looked back over this period, he wrote about his student experience, "I attach myself ever closer to the modern view of the world." This was modernity for Marx, who was after all a provincial boy who had come from Berlin, from the city of Trier. The city of Trier was not the center of the universe. It was a provincial boy who had come to Berlin. And here he found, he discovered the modern view of the world. Now he discovered it under the influence of two people, one I will leave till later. One is called Moses Hess, who became his closest friend. And I will leave him for later, for reasons that will come clear. But above all, under Ruge, who was, in a way, the kind of preceptor, the student leader, the Duschke of his day, you know, the German analogy of today. Now, what was Ruge's ideas? What did he put forward in the Annals of Halle? Hegel, he wrote, unites romantic and free elements. Hegel unites romanticism and freedom. And what we have to do, he said, is cleanse Hegel of romanticism. Now, this is a reaction against the fathers, a reaction against the kind of fraternity system which I've talked about before, a reaction against German nationalism, against singing and dueling and drinking. These were the serious kids who wanted to change society in the 1830s, yes? Who wanted to change society. And who wanted, therefore, to take Hegel, this was the radical theory, but to strip it of romanticism. But what does he mean? What was really the enemy? What was your enemy in the 1830s if you wanted to attack your fathers? If you want to attack society as it was. The enemy, and this is difficult for you to grasp, was still Christianity. If you lived in the 1830s in Germany, it was still Christianity that was the enemy. The church, the reaction. And why? Well, the reason is plain. Because the King of Prussia, Frederick William IV, in whom there had been such great hopes, had turned reactionary, had made an alliance with the church, and was engaged already in a policy of repression, repression of all student movements, repression of all freedom of speech. And Frederick William IV did this in the name of Christianity, in the name of the Prussian church, of which he was head. It was a Protestant church, remember. The Prussian church, of which he was head, and therefore it became quite clear that if you attacked something as a young intellectual, you still attack Christianity. In other words, the Enlightenment hadn't made that much of a difference in Germany. In France, you no longer did that. In France, as I told you last time, you could become a socialist. In France, you wanted to make a revolution. After all, there'd been a French Revolution, other things. In France, you became a Fourierist or a Saint-Simonist, or a Proudhonist, and here religion played very little role. They weren't greatly concerned with Christianity. They were concerned with property. But in Germany, a backward region of Europe, industrially, socially backward region of Europe, unlike France, this becomes very important in a minute, your concern is not with revolution. Your concern is not with changing the social system yet. You're 100 years behind France. Your concern is still with Christianity. And so it was of these young Hegelians. Christianity is the enemy. Now that is important, because so much did the young Hegelians concentrate on the attack on Christianity that they accepted, in a way, Hegel's vision of the state. They were so hung up, if you like, on this attack of Christianity that if you defeated Christianity, you would get freedom, that they didn't pay much attention to Hegel's view of the state. In fact, many of them accepted, as you will see in a minute. Because the state which they envisaged went one step further than Hegel. Hegel's state, I told you before, was a liberal state, a state of laws, if you like, but their state was a democratic state. The young Hegelians foreshadowed 1848. They called for universal suffrage. Their state was a democratic state. They foreshadowed La Salle, in a sense, whom I talked about last time. They foreshadowed that. They talked for democratic state, but they still accepted, if you like, the state. Now, in this kind of atmosphere, Karl Marx got his PhD, and he wrote his doctoral work, to which I shall return later, on Heraclitus. That is to say, of course, a topic in ancient philosophy. And why Heraclitus? You'll have to wait till I get to the problems of Marxism later. Now, the attack, you see, an ancient topic. And again, the attacks on Christianity became violent. A wholesale condemnation for Hegelian reasons, for what the young Hegelians said, that we are now on a higher stage of the dialectic. We have left Christianity behind us. In other words, they made Hegel logical. Hegel had said Christianity is higher than Judaism. Judaism is a fossil. That's where that comes from. And Christianity is higher because, remember, the spirit strives upward. The dialectic always has progress. And then Hegel, somewhat contradictory, had let Christianity stand. He was in a bind about that. He was, after all, a Lutheran minister. He let Christianity stand. Well, the young Hegelians were more logical than Hegel. They said, well, if history is a progress, we are now on the next stage of dialectic, and then Christianity itself must go. Hegel had never been able to say in a kind of illogical way, in a sense, within his system. At the same time, they did something else. And the man who did it was a close friend of Marx, his close associate, Bruno Bauer. And Bruno Bauer, more than any other, turned all this into a doctrine of revolution. Not only were they logical about Hegel's stages of history, they sharpened the dialectic. Now, I've told you about this once before, but I'll repeat it. The Hegelian dialectic is gradual. The new is born like a child from the womb, not by a Caesarean, but gradually by this new method. What is it called? I forget, with all these young people are taking now. Yes? Gradually and happily and through compromise. And Bruno Bauer said, that's wrong. That's wrong. The baby of the new can only be born through revolution. You must have a revolution. The old will not simply have a stage when it compromises with the new and then give away in a kind of compromise, as Hegel had seen, yes? Hegel had seen. Here it is revolution now which is needed. Young people have no patience with compromise. And why is that? And so Bruno Bauer now coined a new word, which again pushes Hegel one step further. Self-alienation. Now, Hegel had never used that word. He had said every higher stage of history, you appropriate more of what it is yours. You become more of a person in every higher stage of history. You become more of a person, more of a total person. Remember, the division of labor and all of this, to which we shall come back. But Bruno Bauer said, well, what Hegel really meant was self-alienation. And there, through revolution, we end self-alienation. Because if it's true that the dialectic leads by stages to progress, and progress is appropriating more and more of what we, more and more of our own personality, not only property and personality are interlinked, remember in this, more and more of your property and more your personality. That means we end self-alienation, we are ending the division of labor, we're ending self-alienation, but self-alienation can only be ended by revolution. Now, that's already a very important revision, radical revision of Hegel. And the way that happens is that man gets rid of the old. Now, in Hegel's terms, what does that mean? It means man gets rid of his false consciousness for a better and truer consciousness, which is the next stage up. What is the false consciousness? Christianity. Therefore, the new stage that comes must shed Christianity. Must shed Christianity because through Christianity, through religion, man becomes estranged from his own self, from his own self-consciousness as he goes up higher the ladder. It estranges man from its self-consciousness. Therefore, as you go up higher the ladder, that is what you must shed to emerge into the new dialectic, which will be transparent again, and so on. But you must emerge, remember, in the dialectic. Religion, therefore, becomes for Bruno Bauer the delusion of a servile people, because there is a final revision which they made, or emphasis they made on Hegel. Progress for Hegel was progress in self-consciousness. Bauer puts it a little differently. As you become more conscious of yourself, you become less servile. That is to say, an end to servility and a beginning of a new dignity. Now, that becomes extremely important from our purpose. Because in all of this, the idea of servility and dignity becomes central, as it is in all socialism, to get rid of servility and to get dignity. And in a Hegelian scheme of things, that means to transcend the old, which here is defined as false consciousness, and to come to a truer consciousness, to a truer consciousness. False consciousness here is, in fact, Christianity, which is, after all, the religion of the moment and the one that dominates thought and action. So they thought, under Frederick William IV, certainly it did to a large extent. Now Marx went along with all of this. He adopted this view of Christianity. The revolutionary implications. But he broke with Bruno Bauer over his view of the state. And he broke with Ruge over the view of the state. Now, for most of these young Hegelians, it was the state which, in the end, was, as with Hegel, the framework in which liberation would take place. And the final liberation would come through the state, through universal suffrage. They took that from Hegel. In other words, Christianity would be abolished. There would be liberation through what we would call, I suppose, a political solution, a solution through the state. Now, to be sure, and to say that straight away, that was dangerous, for the young Hegelians. For Bruno Bauer soon became a German nationalist, a democratic German nationalist. But remember, nationalism was democratic. From asking for universal suffrage, he soon talked about the German Volk, the German people, which must determine its own destiny. A kind of democratic nationalism came out of it all for Ruge and for Bruno Bauer, but especially for Bruno Bauer, who ended up a great admirer of Bismarck and one of the pioneers of modern anti-Semitism as well in the end. So this kind of radicalism that kept the state intact was potentially dangerous because of the great attraction of German nationalism and the great cause of German nationalism and the fact that German youth, as I told you before, radicalized itself to the right, radicalized itself to German nationalism. So you have the great pull to nationalism. You have the great pull to German nationalism. And Bruno Bauer succumbed, Ruge succumbed, and Marx did not succumb. And he did not succumb because he broke with them about this matter of the state. The state. Hegel's view of the state as the integrating element was therefore rejected by Marx as a proper analysis because, of course, it made so little of social and economic factors, because it subordinated social and economic factors to political factors, to the factor of integration. That's exactly what nationalism will do, to subordinate its social and economic factors to the factor of integration. So it's no wonder that these people drifted off to the right, while Marx, of course, did not in this regard. By 1844, Bruno Bauer had begun to travel this road. Marx broke with him and in 1845 wrote a very famous tract against him called The Holy Family. In 1845, A Holy Family. Now, Engels joined Marx in this break with the young Hegelians. And that is really what brought them together. And that is really what will determine their common future. That it was a break is already clear in Marx's first major, if I can put it that way, philosophical work, A Critique of Hegel's Philosophy of Right of 1843. But the interesting thing is, in 1843, in the Critique of Hegel's Philosophy of Right, Marx still admits the state as a framework. And it is only in the Holy Family, 2 years later, in 1845, that the state must wither away. In other words, in 1843, he is still a young Hegelian in that sense. The state is still a framework. By 1845, in the Holy Family, it no longer is. In fact, the Holy Family is an attack on this idea. Nevertheless, even in 1843, significantly, Marx's state is not the state of Hegel as it existed, the state as it existed, with its bureaucracy, civil service. Marx believed from the beginning that the state as it existed atomized people. Whether this was a legacy of Trier, a legacy of his father's fight against Prussia, which made it impossible for him to accept the Prussian state is difficult to say. It probably was. Unlike Bruno Bauer and Ruge, who didn't come from the Rhineland, which was fighting against Prussia, this usurper, this occupying power, they did not have this background. And they accepted the state, but Marx could never really accept it. Even in 1843, it is very uneasy. The state is really atomizes people. It doesn't has nothing to do with universally. And yet, in 1843, he still believes that universal suffrage is part of the answer. He still sees the state as possible. If universal suffrage is instituted, then there can be universal emancipation. He still sees this sort of thing, if you like, in highly idealistic terms. This is what he writes in the critique of Hegel's philosophy of right. What then, he asks the question, what then is the possibility of a German emancipation? He's thinking again of France. I'll come back to that. What is the possibility of a German emancipation in 1843? Answer. In the formation of a class with radical chains, a class of civil society which is not a class of civil society, an estate which is the dissolution of all estates, a sphere which has a universal character by its universal suffering and claims no particular right because no particular wrong, but wrong generally, is perpetrated against it, which can evoke only a human title. In other words, he rejects that any class can be a revolutionary class in 1843. What is oppressed as yet is all of humanity. And therefore, the revolution, the emancipation of Germany, must be on the basis not of a class with radical chains, by which he means a class that is radically oppressed, but emancipation must instead be on a general wrong for all of humanity. All Germans must join together as yet. And this, of course, we would call later on, or Marx would call later on, an idealistic point of view. And in Hegel's critique of the right, all Germans join together in the under the integrating force of the state in universal suffrage to throw over Christianity, to throw over the chain. Now, what changed Marx from an idealist to rejecting the state? What changed Marx from an idealist to what we say to making an original theory in the Holy Family, which is the beginning of an original theory? What changed him? What changed him was France. Between 1843 and 1845 lies his first visit to Paris. And what changed him was France. In Germany, he was a Hegelian. In France, he became a revolutionary. In Germany, he was an idealist. In France, if you like, he combined his idealism with his historical materialism. It was France which, if you like, made the difference here. Why France? Why France? Now remember that Marx spent from 43 to 45 in France, and from 45 to 48 in Brussels, which is an outpost of French culture, that he returned to Germany only once in 1848, that then he visited London in 1849, But that visit lasted the rest of his life, till 1883. It was supposed to be only a visit. So that, and even in England, he looked to France. Even in London, he was constantly preoccupied with France. So that the importance of France in Marxism is equal to the importance of Hegel, is equal to the importance of the young student movement. Why France? Why France? And eventually Lenin will again make that connection of France. Why France? The answer is not very difficult. Because it is France that had broken with the Ancien Régime. Because it is France that had made the revolution. And much later, in 1917, when Lenin will break with the Ancien Régime, it is again France that will be the inspiration. And we must not forget, and something I shall come to at some length, that for Marx, for all his life, the French Revolution was the paradigm of all revolutions. When Marx thought in terms of revolution, this is not just for Marx, that's for everybody. When everybody thought of revolution, he thought of the French Revolution. He thought of the storming of the Bastille. Perhaps our kids still thought of it when they tried to storm Buscombe Hall in 68. But Lenin had the answer. Lenin had the answer. That's after what made Lenin. What made Lenin is that he said, you can't have a French Revolution in the age of the machine gun. Yeah? One little machine gun on Buscombe Hill and you're all gone. Yes, you can storm all you like. Yes? So Lenin realized that. Marx never realized that. Marx never realized that. So that it is still the storming of the Bastille. It is still the French Revolution, and I'll come to that at a greater length. Moreover, as I told you before, here is the laboratory of socialism in the 1830s after a second revolution of 1830. Now remember, until 1848 at any rate, France had a very bad reputation. It was, after all, the nation of revolutions. The French Revolution, the revolution of 1830, the revolution of 1848, and France was the paradigm of radicalism. When I still taught freshmen, there was a wonderful sort of a little saying you could tell them to make them remember it, what they said in the 19th century. They said, when France sneezes, Europe catches cold. And this is, of course, totally correct, both in the French Revolution and in 1848. These upheavals started in France. So obviously, any revolutionary would look to France, as any revolutionary after 1918 would look to Russia. Any revolutionary in the 19th century would look to France. That was quite logical, quite obvious. And France, of course, became the laboratory of thought. Now, it is true, of course, that Marx rejected the French socialists as utopian. And though he rejected and later on come to hate bitterly Proudhon and Fourier and the Saint-Simonists that I talked about last time, nevertheless he learned in France something very important. Yes, the importance of economics and social analysis. For whatever you say about Proudhon and Fourier, and certainly the Saint-Simonists, they all had social and economic analysis, which in Germany didn't go very far. Hegel is very feeble on that, really. And of course, the young Hegelians weren't really basically interested in social and economic analysis. But you could hardly come to Paris of the 1930s, liberal Paris, with its political ferment, not to get an idea of all the discussions of social and political analysis, wherever you went to the cafes or Montmartre or anywhere else, you would find that kind of discussion. Marx went out. Mrs. Marx left, stayed behind, of course. Marx went out to these cafes and talked and discussed and debated. And it's less important for him in Paris that there was Proudhon and there was Fourier and there was Saint-Simon. That was not important for him. Very important was a Jewish exile, Berner, the great liberal, and very important to him was Heinrich Heine, whom he came to know in Paris. But Heinrich Heine and Berner, fellow German exiles, were interested in social and economic analysis. And though they were not socialists, and though Marx and Heine later broke, it was Heine who introduced him to Paris, and it was Berner who introduced him to Paris. And it wasn't the Paris of Proudhon, it wasn't the Paris of Fourier, but it was the Paris of intense intellectual discussion in the salons, in the cafes, that this young provincial from Germany, anybody from Germany in Paris was by definition a provincial, was introduced to this society through Heinrich Heine, through Berner, and the friendship with Heine, as some of you know, lasted the rest of his life. He got from France something else, that the kind of dignity which was important to him, which was always of overriding importance of Marx, the kind of dignity which is an outsider. Remember, Marx was a double outsider. He'd been outsider as a Jew in Trier, and now he was an outsider as a revolutionary. So obviously the idea of dignity was very important to him. Emancipation and dignity. That's why he looked at the Enlightenment. This again he could get from France and French discussions. The idea of the kind of dignity that you had there in France itself. Thus the French experience then combined with Hegel. And eventually, of course, Marx will reject both the state and Christianity. And what I want to do on Friday is I want to talk a little about that and then take Marx's most controversial, devote the rest of the hours to Marx's most misunderstood and controversial tract, his tract on the Jews, to illustrate to you his break with both of these, of 1845.